Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So nice to see you all. What a treat. It's been a long time since I've sat with the Jikoji Sangha, and it's always a refreshing moment to see your faces again. Nice to see you, Michael. Great, great pleasure. So we're on our second day of Floating Zendo's session. It's taken a great deal of effort to put it together, and now it's just chugging along and very nicely. The rare occasion of gathering together and sitting and practicing in quiet is tastes delicious, I would say. It's so rare for us and so precious for the survival not only of us but of the whole human race. We don't sit just for our own development, maturing, insight. In fact, mostly we sit as our world and for our world. Dogen said, if you want to see Buddha nature, you must be very humble. And I think our humility comes when we realize it's not about me. In fact, when we begin to look into what me is, it becomes more and more questionable whether I can achieve anything at all with this apparently very silly practice. It doesn't create fireworks for us. In fact, as we progress in our life becomes more difficult, and our practice becomes more difficult, and the more deeply committed we are to practicing, the more of a challenge it becomes. The more we step out of the way and make ourselves available for what's happening in our world, the more of a challenge it is for us. And yet, at the same time, as we practice in humility, we're meeting Buddha over and over again. As Dogen said, and not in terms of fireworks either, but in terms of the selfless nature of all things and the impermanent nature of all things. Our pride comes from when we hold on not only to our self, the picture we have of ourself, but also of our sense of importance in the world. It comes up when we have ordinations and discussing the hierarchy of Zen. Who are you when you become, when you're wearing a robe and you're not just an ordinary person anymore? does wearing a robe make you more important and full, have a right to feel very proud? But Zen is a very earthy practice. It's a very humility comes from humus, the Latin word that talks about the rich, decaying matter in the forest, the matter that is feeding the forest. It's very sweet smelling. It's luscious, but it's nothing anybody would write home about. Nothing special. So that's really our practice. And as we proceed, or as life proceeds us, when we bump into things that invariably we do that bring us down, that's always a moment for celebration. Ah, that's the way it is. Of course, I forgot. Instead of saying, oh, why does this happen to me? This shouldn't happen to me. I've got it all together, and I've got my practice all together. And then, boom, something happens, and some humiliation comes. Humus, humiliation, brings us back down to the floor of the forest, feeding the roots, feeding all the creatures who live there. We don't know exactly what we are or who we are. Until we're very quiet and willing to accept and allow what we already know. And yet we say we sit with dignity and strength, that we hold ourselves upright and sit, who was it who said, sit like a lion, you know, gazing out over the forest or something. And that too is important, to be able to trust ourselves, to trust this bag of bones and blood that we call our body, mind, to be this thoroughly, 100%. Because humility can bring us that kind of courage. We don't have to be worried about how we appear. If we're willing to appear with our full authentic self, the wholeness of us, the truth of us, and not just in the Zendo and not just in the Sangha, but in the whole Sangha of the universe. How we meet the people in the street, how we meet our relatives, how with confidence we can give confidence to others. And confidence comes when we can hold ourselves, or commit ourselves to our seat. As we said yesterday, just to be where we are and who we are. And trust it to be enough. And of course, in the general run of things, if we start to judge how we're doing, we never live up to anything. Judgment is a very tricky thing. And it's always comparing to something else. And really, there's nothing else to compare to. Each one is completely unique. Each one of us. It's kind of strange, isn't it? And yet here we are all together, finding our way, or allowing to be found, or submitting ourselves to something we don't quite have words for. I think of Koban often and how he was so simple, so plain. He was just a little guy you could run into at the farmer's market. And yet he was thoroughly and completely what he was. Including the complexities of his life, which were no more or less complex than our own. And he too, in his best moments, was a very humble man who gave so much to create spaces for us, a space like this. To which he invited everyone in. The everyone that ordinary people would call unacceptable people. And who would call them sort of dirt, which we might think of as humus in the forest. That the people that he accepted were the rejects, the runaways, and the lost. This was the library. Big stacks of books. And we took all the books out, and Koban invited everybody in. Please come and sit with us. So the Vietnam vets and the runaway kids and the nun who left the convent and the hippie kids, some of them came. And in any sense, they were invited. And so that by itself created a condition for them that lasts. So that many years later, one of the most difficult ones came back all dressed in a fine suit and a tie. The one that used to play loud rock music during Sesshin, just so that we would know he was there.
And called himself Wizard.
Yes, called himself Wizard. And for Koban's students, the example of inviting in the unacceptable and accepting them. 100%. Was an example of Zen. that didn't need words, didn't need sutras. It didn't need anything but his example. And we thought, if he can do it, we can do it. So that was the beginning of this place. And we're still doing it. We're still learning. It's hard. It's not a pretty picture, this world we are. And yet our mind is able to open and able to be with what we meet and allow it to be. Koban translated the fourth bodhisattva vow, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to allow it. We resist so much, of course. We create boundaries for ourselves, and necessarily so. We have to stay safe and sane so that opening ourselves is also with care. So that both sides are available to us. The mind that is so-called ordinary mind, and the mind that is so wide that it includes all, every. It's not so comfortable to be stuck on one side or the other. If you need to chop wood, go out and chop wood. If you need to clean the altar and set up for a ceremony, that's the other side. But it's not two sides, of course, at all. We just get stuck on one side or the other and think it so. So sitting this way in a week, for a week, is our privilege to enter the forest and become one with it. Enter the Sangha and become one with it. To enjoy our sitting and become one with it. Become one with those that we're with and those we know. Those that we will never know. We're all sitting together. When I first started to sit, I had three children at home, and I was fortunate to be able to go to Sesshin during the day when the children were in school. I'd put them on the bus in the morning, and then I'd go half a mile down the hill to Hidden Villa and sit with Koban and Sangha until it was time to go home and make supper. And so I at first felt very badly about it, that I was missing out on most of it, and that I felt funny coming in and out that way. And then I began to feel how it was that it wasn't two different places. That the Zendo and what I had thought was so special, something came with me when I went home. And when I went back to the Zendo, something came with me from home. And I realized, sort of like, why didn't you know this before? But it was revelation that it was the same, with a little path that looked like it was in between, but there was no in between at all. And so now, this session, I'm discovering it all over again. And it's revelation again. It's really amazing. So you will see me occasionally, and occasionally you will not. And it's the same. It's just the same. It's all. And there are also so many people who are sitting with us who are not here. People who call me and say, please remember that I'll be sitting with you even though I can't be there. So it's much wider, much larger than we know. We ourselves are much wider and larger than we know. So, there's time for questions, discussion.
So Kobin welcomed everyone. How hard was it for you and for the others to welcome everyone?
It was scary.
Very hard.
It was scary hard, yes. It was. I mean, some of them were pretty reprehensible folks. Wizard being one. June and I had to go and talk to him about some serious subject, something that we wanted from him, and he wouldn't even get out of bed to talk to us. He just had us come in and sit by his bed, and he started talking about what a great guy he was and what a scary guy he was, and told us that he had been at prison anyway, and so he knew all kinds of tricks, and he knew how to press one part of your neck in a certain way and it would kill you right on the spot. It was two little women. We just looked at it. Is that so? Oh? And so it was like that. It was not easy. There was one guy who just argued and argued and argued forever about everything. And when he left, finally, he was one of the last to leave. He left a big poop in the middle of the Zendo floor.
Right here.
Yeah, right here. You remember.
And there was a stain.
Yes. Yes.
More than a little mulch.
More than a little mulch. Yeah.
It was like this big.
Yeah, good saving it up. So it was like that. And there was one occasion when Kobin took one on, that famous story of the knife. And that person was really probably the most dangerous person on site. And I think Coben called his bluff at that point, and he wasn't such a problem after that.
How did it enlarge your faith? I mean, when you're dealing with the edge, basically you had to.
Yes. Well, in a way, you already kiss yourself goodbye when you start doing something like this, start a project like this. It becomes not about you at all. And you don't know whether it'll go or not. And you have to be willing to let it do what it wants to. It's all very unknown. So that's the whole thing is about faith. Utter faith. Not that it will succeed, but that whatever is supposed to happen. And we'll do our best to go along with whatever is meant here. So and once you get in, once you kiss yourself goodbye, and we do that over and over, I think, in our lives, then people's threats aren't so significant. You sort of see through it. You see through that there's somebody underneath all that bluff who needs something and wants something and is hurting. And so the effort is to just be with that and not ignore the other, because you don't want him to use that little trick, but not to submit yourself to total danger. But if you're going to be with them, to really be that way. I think that's what compassion means, is to wisely care for what you are needing. But it's caring for first. Peter?
Angie, is the faith you just referred to, Doug referred to, is it essentially the same as the trust that was mentioned yesterday, the trust that we refer to in our practice so often as a foundation of our practice?
Yes.
So there's a distinction between the faith and trust as we use those concepts.
Well, faith is a religious word, and so it has a religious connotation. But it appears in the word confidence and fidelity. You know, fide is the original Latin. So with faith is confidence. And that's trust. Trust in oneself, meaning confidence, but with compassion, it's trust entirely. It's allowing. Jane?
Knowing some of the subsequent history of Jikoji and how people's attempts to fulfill that vision have made other residents here feel very physically threatened. How did Coben establish boundaries, perhaps not with the untouchables of our society, but with his students?
By slipping out from under. Mm-hmm. That was his way. We would together create a situation, mm-hmm. And if he felt it was not going the right way, he would just disappear. Often. Or do something really radical.
Before the shit hit the fan?
Yeah. Right before the shit hit the fan.
Experience your own consequences.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He always seemed so kind and so gentle, but that seemed to me so cruel. You know, he would just, bam, like that. It would just be, he'd be out of there, or not any help at all. And we left it up to us to do it. Us! How could he do that? He was our daddy. Not. And there were other ways too, of course. He was very stern sometimes. Very, very stern. And
you talk about one of those times.
Well, there was a real difficulty in the Santa Cruz Zendo. And nobody quite knew what to do about it. And there was a real difficulty up here that nobody quite knew what to do about. And so suddenly, he found a way to persuade the people who were living up here to go down and live in Santa Cruz and more or less take care of the situation. So it all happened so fast that I didn't even know what was happening until it was over. But he just removed one obstacle and then another one. And then everything had to adjust again. There were all these adjustments that have to take place. So that's part of it, too. It's well to keep the Sangha a little on edge. Like Dido Laurie used to do with his wonderful way of getting the Sangha mad at each other for the same subject. So Copen didn't go quite that far, but he could have. Dido, when they first set up their now a very big monastery, they inherited a house and a little house in the back and a guy in the little house with a dog. And half the Sangha wanted the guy out of there because they were creating this holy space and the guy didn't belong. And the other people said, oh, but this is a sentient being and we should love him and take care of him. And so they were having all these arguments. And so Dido went to the head of one group, the group that wanted to get rid of him, and started telling him all the bad things that this guy was. He was really stinky and horrible, and you really don't need him there. And then he went to the other group and said, you know, this guy, he's really kind and lovely, and he just sounded out. And they all started arguing back again, and then he pointed it out to them, and there was total silence. They were shocked. Because they just had been swayed without even realizing it so easily. So easily. That's when teachers can have fun.
You look like you're having fun telling the story.
Wonderful to see you.
You were on this notion of fun. I was thinking about a wonderful story of walking back at the end of the day from Hidden Villa. That must have been just wonderful to do that for so long. And then just recently you said that teachers kind of maybe had fun, or he had fun. You said also how it influenced your taking, something happened by being in the Zendo while you came home. Did you have fun there too as a mother?
Oh, I did. Oh, I did. We had a wonderful time.
Can you, something simple, something clear that you can elaborate on? Or?
I think just appreciating so much. You know, when you're up to here with your kids, it just seems like it's all kids. And then if you have the chance to go away, even for a few hours, you come back and it's a different scene. I just really appreciated my kids when I got back. Oh, here they are, my little Buddhas. And then they do something really stupid and I go. But it did influence how I felt about my family. Yeah.
Appreciate
them, yeah, for their vigor and their amazing differences in character, and I learned a lot from them. Chris?
Well, I was just thinking there's another part of that that was also very hard on Coben, I think, to be so open to so many people. And that's a part of it that I think he struggled with.
Oh, big time. In the beginning, people just completely took him for granted. They call him up in the middle of the night with having a fight with a wife or something and say, could you come over and help us? And he often would. Or people would come over in the middle of the night and ask to come in and talk for long hours. And people just thought he was offering himself up for in service to them, without realizing that he was a living being who had just as many needs and problems and that everybody else has. So it was just the kind of ignorance, because nobody had ever come to America like that before and offered himself, and we didn't have we didn't know how to behave. It was true for Suzuki Roshi, too. People would gather around, sort of crowd him as he would come out of a car and appear somewhere. And just not have enough couth around someone who is, of course, very tender. And so it was hard. It was painful. People learned after a while. You know, at first it was really difficult. And people kept not wanting to give him any money, because one person said, who had been a longtime student of Suzuki Roshi, she said, oh, why don't you get a job? Why don't you be a gardener? He said, you want me to be a gardener?
People said that before?
Yeah. Yeah. So. I assume he was a gardener.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's what Japanese people were known for in this area. So, of course, if you're Japanese, you get a job as a gardener. And you can do this other thing on the side. So it was hard. It was. Paula?
This is the part about big thought that COVID can do it, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
I fell down pretty hard on that one myself. Thinking that, and then I was just seeing COVID from the outside, and for a while there, I tried to be the way I thought he was, and sort of that way, and he seemed to be so accepting of anything, and so open. And I think coming to Jikoji here, when the others were here that didn't want to go, and that most of them really didn't like us, that was a moment of having to say no. Coleman can do it, but I can't do it.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm really still amazed that you stuck it out. I'm so glad you did.
Well, you had a small child. And that made a huge difference. That's all the difference there is. That's your practice. Small child comes first, no matter what. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't a scene for a small child. But larger children, my children, helped a lot. They were old enough to do some carpentry and to haul some junk. They hauled a lot of junk.
Endless
junk, yes.
Junk hauling?
Pardon?
Yeah.
Wait, sorry.
Did you help with the junk hauling?
Weren't you part of that too?
I applauded a lot.
Appreciative audience. Yeah.
Have you met Toby? He's about twice as big as I am and really a great junk hauler. I helped him with a while back. But.
They gave Coben the torch to start burning down the domes, the platforms. Apparently, here, Coben, would you like to?
Yes.
Because now that they weren't living here, they didn't want them moving back.
Right.
Even though a lot of those domes were some of the best designed domes in the world, and they made it into a book. But I had to get rid of the domes.
Open Space did that. They were all on open space property, so we told them we would take care of it for them, and actually the volunteer fire department did it.
Oh.
They used it for training. They brought all their trainees, and they all had these yellow costumes and masks and tanks on their back and the whole thing, and then they would throw gasoline into the dome and it would flare up, and then they'd all rush in and put it out. And then they'd burn it up again and put it out. So it took quite a while to exterminate them all. And it was a loss, but
they did give Coben the torch.
To begin. Yes. And we offered incense for each one. Just as we offered incense for every tree that we took out. Just to acknowledge it and appreciate it.
A more serious note, we had a conversation less in the Sangha at Canon Do, and Coben came up and his tragedy, his death, and something came to my mind about in airplanes, with something like tragic happens and it's going to head down. They have a diagram and the thing drops down and you put a mask on. And it says, you may have a picture of a child. Put your mask on first.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to finally, probably, to save your child.
Yes.
That doesn't seem to gel or jive with the story that I have of what happened with Coben, and that's all these stories are. We miss him very much. His death affects so many people. He didn't put the mask on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I heard he didn't even know how to swim.
Oh, he did not know how to swim. That's part of the myth. That's part of the myth.
Well, Mike said he actually dove into, as a kid, into the bottom of the pond head first.
Oh, yeah, that's when he was a toddler.
But you understand maybe what I'm... I don't understand someone so wise and having so much effect, but being oblivious to what would happen, I guess, by not putting the mask on first.
I don't know what that would be in that situation.
Did he have ropes on then or not?
No, they were just having lunch in the porch in the backyard.
Yeah, back lunch.
And the pond was right there. It was a little formal pond. It is a little formal pond. And it's not deep. So there was no reason to think there was anything to be worried about. Although Catherine was. She really hadn't wanted to go there because she was afraid for that pond. And they would have gone to Felsentor, but there was no room for them. So it has a lot of issues that occurred around it. They ended up at Vanya's because there wasn't room at Felsentor. And they were having lunch in right there where the children were watching them. And then a little boy came and said, Maya's in the water. So he just went to get Maya. So I think any parent would do that. You know.
And there she is up there.
It's a metaphor, though, also in other instances of, you know,
yes,
survive in a way to help other survive. And it's actually a huge metaphor. Can be.
Yes, yes. But it's different with a child who needs a parent's help and students. You want your students to be grown-ups.
I often see my wife as a child sometimes, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. That's not... Yes. Thank you, Todd. How are we for time? Anybody know? Oh, thank you, Peter. Thank you all. Very happy to see you all.